Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I don't think we should fund the construction of new coal-fired power plants for two reasons. Firstly, my view is that government should not be in the business of doing something where the market's not prepared to do it itself. Then the second thing is obviously, how does it fit in with a transition to a carbon neutral economy?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. You're with Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and the show is Australian Politics Live. And across from me in the pod cave is Trent Zimmerman. Say hi, Trent.
Hi, thanks for having me on my first podcast. I thought you were going to say Trent Zimmerman, federal member for North Sydney. That's who I am, by the way.
That is true. Yes, yes. Trent Zimmerman is the federal member for North Sydney. I should give the full title. And it's true. Trent has told me that this is his first ever podcast, so I'm kind of semi-honoured.
Well, I'm full of nervous anticipation.
No, you're not. It'll be lovely. Anyway, I want to start our conversation this week just giving you a bit of background, because you're not a big podcast listener. After the election last year, a couple of months after the election, I invited Keith Pitt, who is a Queensland National, into the podcast with me to describe what happened on the ground in Queensland during the election. And by what I mean what happened, I suppose the appeal that Nats were making to a traditional Labor Party constituency, and coal was the issue. Anyway, he said some quite interesting things. But it occurs to me, and this is part of why I want to have this conversation with you, is that I have not had a conversation with someone from another part of the coalition, Heartland, where equally interesting things happened during the election campaign. So I want to start there, even though it feels to you and I like ancient history. It feels like,
it's only 7-8 months ago.
No, I know, yeah. But like, I feel like I've lived 9 lives, and I'm sure you do too, right? Yeah. But I think it's worth starting there and talking about an alternate experience during that campaign. So Pitt's narration was, you know, the being sort of, you know, all for coal really helped us, got us blue collar votes. I mean, it's not that crude, but I'm summarising. But obviously you represent a very metropolitan electorate with pretty progressive constituents. So what was your experience?
Well, I think election campaigns are interesting because you're dealing with, in your own electorate, 110,000 individuals, and they do have a shopping basket of issues. I would say that economic policy probably was the dominant issue, and there were other issues that were not unrelated, like franking credits, which was sure. Very much alive for seniors. But it's also fair to say, and I'd be downplaying if I didn't, that climate change was certainly a big issue in my electorate as well.
And what did people say to you?
They want Australia to take climate change seriously. They want the government to take it seriously, and most would like us to do more.
Do you think that experience was replicated in other electorates, other metropolitan electorates that are similar to yours?
I do. And I should qualify to start by saying that it's obviously, in my view, probably a majority view amongst my constituents, but it's not the only view. You do have people who take a different course of action, different course of thinking on climate change. And one of the things that strikes me actually about campaigning is that we do tend to, maybe more than we used to, live in a little bubble of, little bubble of people who tend to share our own values.
Yeah, sure.
So it comes as quite a shock to people who don't believe in climate change when I tell them I think a majority of my electorate probably do. So,
right.
Vice versa.
So that, yeah, well, Well, that's a whole other conversation.
It is.
About people with different views not bothering to speak to one another. But anyway, okay, so the prevailing, the majority view in your electorate is in favour of climate action.
Correct.
You think it's similar in other electorates that are similar to yours. Certainly talking to some of your colleagues in similar electorates, that's the impression I get. And then we have what happened in Warringah. Yeah. So what happened in Warringah?
Well, we lost.
I think that is what the record shows.
Yeah,
yes.
But look, I think, again, obviously, there were a range of issues that were at play there, but from my perspective, climate change was, if not the top issue, was certainly in the top three. And I think that Tony Abbott was obviously vulnerable on that issue, and that was reflected in the outcome.
And so I suppose the lived experience of that is that the Liberal Party has lost a seat on climate change. I mean, you and I would be in firm agreement that the Tony Abbott case study is complicated by, you know, he's a very high profile figure. People have very strong views about high profile figures, right? It's not all climate. You and I both know that. But you think it was significant. It certainly looks significant from the outside.
I think if you looked at policy issues, it was the most significant policy issue.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's quite interesting and obviously very different to Keith Pitt's experience. Now, okay, so your constituents think the government needs to do more in relation to climate change. What do you think?
Well, yes, I do think that we need to do some more. And that's not to say I don't think we're doing a lot already, and I think that's often undervalued and underrated. And I agree with the Prime Minister's premise that technology is going to be our salvation, to put it in religious terms. Mm. And frankly, I get quite excited about that. I'm someone who's very interested in Australia's role in innovation and technology. And I personally think that one of the changes that we need to make, at least in language, but also in what we're trying to achieve economically, is that I actually think that Australia can be a powerhouse for low emissions technology. We've got a history, really a whole solar panels on your rooftop homes being commercially available as the result of work at UNSW. So. And there's so many exciting opportunities that Australia has in really developing its role in low emissions technology.
And do you think that that there is a potential pivot point if we're talking about the government doing more with commitments in the international framework out to 2050? Now, a number of Australian state governments have adopted net zero by 2050. Does that milestone present the government with an opportunity to step up, do a bit more, be a bit more ambitious?
I'm keen for us to look at doing a 2050 target. The PM's said that we are looking at it, and we're doing our due diligence. I don't think that's unreasonable, because one of the things I do know about politics is it's very easy to proclaim a target, a goal, but unless you've got the plan to back it up, unless you understand how you're going to get there, it can be not much more than a political platitude. So I think it is important we do the due diligence, but it does make sense to me in many ways, not least of which because, and a lot of people don't realise this, but as part of our Paris Agreement targets, we have agreed to basically move to a net carbon neutrality.
Yes.
I always stumble over those words. Yeah. Carbon neutrality, but by the second or in the second half of the century.
Well, I was going to put this to you because Simon Birmingham just, well, I said, I think somewhere on social media this week, thank God Burmo's read the Paris Agreement, like someone actually understands what you've signed up to. You have actually signed up to this.
Well, the other component of Paris is obviously the commitment that we made, every nation has signed up to it, to meet the target of temperature rises not more than 1.5 to 2%, depending on which parameters you're using.
No, exactly, and that requires net zero. So, but do you think that this will be contentious within the government, even if it is, even if it's sort of, I don't know why I laugh, but I mean, even if, look, you've already done it, you and I kind of agree, you've already done it by signing up to Paris, but there is a process obviously within government to establish what the target is, what the roadmap for getting there is, do presumably some modelling of costings, all of this sort of stuff, right? So all of that's got to happen. But this will be quite contentious, though,
it
internally.
It will. And your discussion with Keith Pitt is an indicator of why, because one of the things I do understand is that views do change depending on what part of the country you're in. And I have colleagues who I speak to in good faith and genuinely who will tell me that in their electorates, climate change wouldn't be in the top 10 issues that are being raised with them by their voters. In mine, it's not the case, but and that's talking frankly amongst us to each other. So you do get those different perspectives being represented in our party room. And as you know, energy policy within the coalition party room has not been always the easiest of tasks.
Well, that's a very diplomatic way of summarising the last 10 years. As you brought up the war.
I knew as soon as I said that I was making a mistake.
Oh, no, not at all. No. What's happened over the last 10 years is that climate change has been weaponized in the Australian political debate. It's become an artifact of partisan politics. Now, it won't surprise you, Trent, to hear me say to you, your side of politics has played a more destructive role in this than other actors in the political system, although you're not alone in destruction and mistakes. Everybody's made mistakes here. But the person who chose to weaponise this issue was Tony Abbott. He weaponised this issue. Now, was that a mistake?
Well, I wasn't in the parliament at the time.
I'm
trying to find ways to get out to answering this.
I'm not blaming you. Honest question. Yeah. Was this a mistake? I think it was such a big mistake, I struggle to find the words to articulate it. What do you think?
I think that we lost a good half a decade because of the debate about what we needed to do. Now, I accept that there are different ways of skinning the cat. I think that you can actually reach these targets without having a carbon price. And so, therefore, I don't think that's an unreasonable proposition to put. And I actually thought Greg Hunt was a very good Minister for the Environment and Energy. And in terms of those parameters of what he was seeking to achieve in the early days of the Abbott government. Do I think that this should be the central point of the political contest? The answer to that is no. I think the challenge of climate change is so real and so serious that if there is some type of consensus, then that would be a positive outcome. Am I optimistic that that will occur? Probably not, but it's worth trying. People like consensus, but part of our democracy is obviously not being afraid to have the debate.
Oh, no, I'm not opposed to conflict. Conflict is politics and conflict is representative democracy, but it's whether it's conflict with a view to trying to synthesise something, trying to get to an outcome, or whether it's constant, whether you weaponise something because it's politically advantageous for you to do it.
Yeah.
So you said you think you can get to a more ambitious target without carbon pricing.
Correct.
Right? Like some other option. So what are the options?
Well, interestingly, Alan Finkel spoke to the National Press Club recently, and I thought he laid out a very good roadmap, and he talked about the technology agenda. He said that technology is the way that we fuel our transition, an orderly transition, I think was the word he used. And so, for example, in the agenda that he laid out, it's obviously a transition that occurs towards renewable power, recognises that gas will play a role as a transitional fuel, but he also identifies the potential, and it's a bit of a crusade for him, of hydrogen.
He's massively into it.
But and I have enormous respect for Professor Finkel. I think he's one of the greatest thinkers we have in the country. But if you look at the potential of hydrogen as he outlines it, it is so significant, and not just for fueling our own needs, but also as a major export industry. He points the fact, I think by 2050, it'll be a $2 trillion industry at the predicted growth rate of hydrogen. So
it's a matter of governments supporting the development of new industries, or how do you get there without, like, let's look at the New South Wales agreement, which I'm sure you've followed very closely, right? The bilateral agreement between Scott Morrison and Gladys Berejiklian.
Which we want to replicate around the country.
Around the country, right. So that's another model for rolling out abatement without necessarily putting it up in lights that that's what you're doing, right? Mm. So is that it? Is that what we've got now? I mean, I'm not sort of having a, you know, massive nostalgia kind of trip for market mechanisms, yeah. But do you think there is?
I think they're the parameters that we're working within. And look, getting to 2050 and to carbon neutrality is not easy. It's not a walk in the park by any stretch. No. But the other policy prescription that I read over Christmas was Ross Garnaut's book, Superpower. Mm-hmm. And what I liked about that book is that Ross Garnaut basically said, look, you've got a government that was elected with certain election commitments that set the parameters. Those election commitments, even though it would be his preference for carbon pricing or an ETS, are not going to happen, and the world just needs to get used to that because the government doesn't have a mandate to do to change that. And then he outlined what I thought was some of the exciting opportunities that we have. Now, he obviously talked about the central role of technology in dealing with the challenge, and really, I think, spoke so optimistically about how we can actually make the silver lining a reality. But secondly, he obviously identified other things that government can do. So, and some of this we're already starting to do. So, for example, if you look at the renewable sector at the moment, which has taken off, our own projections say 50% renewable by 2030 and across Australia. But how do you help facilitate that to 2030 and beyond? There are things we obviously need to do. We need to firm the renewables, and that can be done with things like gas or hydro or batteries. But also, really, I think, and this type of stuff is never sexy because you're not seeing it or observing it, but really getting the transmission network right is, I think, the most important thing.
Well, it's critically important. That's, like, in my mind, that's the most important bit of the New South Wales deal, because that basically allows a substantial renewable energy zone to feed power into the grid.
Well, there are two aspects of it. I mean, the proposal that Matt Keane has been pursuing is to establish and pilot, in the first case, these regional renewable energy zones, and by concentrating them, what that allows you to do is obviously more easily connect them to the grid. But beyond that, I think that we will have to increase our transmission capacity to other areas as well, because by its nature, renewable energy tends to be more geographically spread than a single coal-fired power station. So getting the transmission network right, I think, is the most important challenge. But the other things I'm excited about is, for example, this year we are finalising electric vehicle strategy. It's something I've had a long interest in. A long time ago, I used to be a North Sydney councillor, 15 years ago, I think it was, proposing that in our building codes we should be requiring buildings to have
at least
the conduits for electricity for the future of electric vehicles. And at the time, I was considered a little bit of a novelty in pursuing that. But that's of itself going to require major planning, because obviously if you roll out electric vehicles in any significant scale, you have to make sure that your grid can cope with people charging it. You're going to try and obviously ensure that it's being powered by green energy and not traditional fuel sources. And you obviously need the network of recharging stations as well.
You've raised electric vehicles. The coalition in the recent election campaign took Labor's strategy on electric vehicles and declared that this was a war on the weekend. So how is the coalition, and this is sort of goes to the broader point about repositioning, right? Like, you think the coalition needs to reposition. I agree. We desperately need you to do that. But it is it's a very complicated exercise to align some of past statements with future intentions. So how do you go about doing that?
Well, I think there is a difference in approach and in debate, which is most effective. But I think with an electric vehicle strategy, for example, a command and control approach, which says that by X date you shall do X or Y, is something that we are less likely to come at, and I think, frankly, the community is less likely to support. So for me, in an area like electric vehicles, what is the role the federal government can play? And the states are already doing a lot, so it's got to be a partnership. We are already funding projects through ARENA,
fast charging stations.
So the work is already happening. But partly it's just going to be a force of the market, in the sense that the cost of vehicles will come down. There isn't really an affordable electric vehicle on the market in Australia at the moment. Will that be fast enough? Possibly not. So I think there is a case, for example, for the states to look at financial incentives through registration fees, even through toll fees. And I think in my own electorate, one of the big issues that state government's facing is debates about pollution from new tunnels, road tunnel projects, because that debate goes away. You've got electric vehicles because there are no emissions. So, for example, do you offer some type of toll rebate if you're actually using one of those tunnel projects in an electric vehicle and not producing any emissions? But obviously a key factor in Australia which has hindered electric vehicles is the psychological fear that we have. We all like to dream that we travel vast distances every weekend. Most of us don't. But we have this psychological aversion because we are worried that we're going to be halfway across the Nullarbor and find the battery runs out.
Yeah.
So I think the charging network is actually going to be really crucial.
But in terms of the sort of the basic disposition, so it would be carrots rather than sticks. So it was the issue with Labor's policy. I mean, well, let's set aside, you know, just crude politics, and let's just talk about what was wrong with that proposal. Was your objection that there were vehicle standards embedded in that, or emission standards embedded in that, that it should all be incentives, it should all be rewarding the consumer for doing the right thing
I think that's a starting point, particularly in the early days. And I think once you've got acceptance within the community, then you might look at measures down the track. But the first instance is carrying the community with you. And I think importantly to that, you are not telling someone what type of car they should have. Mm-hmm. You are explaining why there might be a better option, and you're making it practically and financially attractive for them to consider that option.
Okay. Now,
and I think once you get that penetration, it is getting the penetration to a point where I think it becomes the norm.
Well,
and people see the benefits.
Yeah, a tipping point happens in the market, and then, but I agree, affordability is a big issue.
And I think once you get to the price where there is affordable, and look, the global car market is heading only in one direction, and the amount that's being invested by the big car manufacturers is just extraordinary, and we will get cheaper vehicles on the market. And once you've got parity in terms of purchase price, your running costs are going to be lower, your fuel costs are going to be lower, so it's going to make a lot of sense.
How do you win these? I want to get to coal power because I know you have views about that. I want to get to that in a sec, but how do you win these arguments internally?
Well, I think it is easier because no one's arguing that we should revisit whether we have a carbon price or an ETS. These are things that can be done where we're not telling people that they have to do something. We're providing them an incentive to do it themselves. This is effectively using government funding to create leverage and to provide a catalyst funding, is the way I describe it, for certain things to happen until pricing in the markets can take over once you have something that's established in the field. So I think that within those parameters, it is a lot easier. But I don't shy away from the fact that saying that we're going to have a shiny new target is not going to be a challenge.
Because you want change to happen. You're not alone. It's very striking to me that a number of you have come back into this parliamentary year very focused on this and not inclined to hush your voices. So you want the change to happen, but that 2050, the obvious pivot point of 2050, which will enable a conversation, you will have to have a conversation about a target.
Yeah.
What do you do in order to persuade?
But let me be clear on that, though, because I'm not saying let's adopt the 2050 target. I'm saying that let's do the due diligence. Yeah. I think that is something that we should be looking very seriously at, because it makes sense. It makes sense in terms of our Paris Agreement targets. It makes sense with what the states are doing and so many other nations are doing. But we do have to have an understanding about how you get there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's why I say do the due diligence before signing on the
dotted line. No, you're very clear about that. I mean, obviously it's something you would like to see adopted, but not in a vacuum. You've got to actually understand how you do it, what the costs are, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct.
But it is like, how do you persuade George Christensen this is a good idea? And I mean, I'm not personalising that. I mean, like, substitute anybody, right? George just popped into my head. as he does.
Well, I think that the key to it is actually explaining to him and his community how, firstly, the transition is not going to be a disaster for them, but secondly, not only is it not going to be a disaster, but there's actually going to be new opportunities that arise for a community like his and across Australia. So we have to try and take people on that journey. Now, will you always succeed? Probably not 100%, but you've got to give it a go.
Mm. Well, obviously, and Christensen brings us to Cole and Collinsville and et cetera. Now, should taxpayers fund, underwrite new coal plants?
I don't think we should fund the construction of new coal-fired power plants for two reasons. Firstly, my view is that government should not be in the business of doing something where the market's not prepared to do it itself. And the market makes a reasonable assessment, not always, but in most cases, about what in the long term is going to be viable. So it's a very liberal philosophical objection to that. I should say that occasionally it's thrown back to me, well, how do you justify investing so much in Snowy Mountains Hydro or renewable energy full stop?
Yeah, and, or subsidies for mining.
And I would say that, for example, in relation to Snowy, the difference is that is a government-owned asset. It is our asset, and we are making effectively a commercial investment in its upgrade as the owner. But more broadly, my view is, and we see this across so many areas of government policy, the government acts as a catalyst agent, be it export market development grants, be it the work, the funding that we give to science or innovation. It's basically making sure that we can get people off the ground before they have to survive on their own two feet. And I don't think you could say that the coal fire power station sector falls into that category.
Falls into that category.
But then the second thing is obviously how does it fit in within a transition to a carbon neutral economy?
Mm. Yeah. Well, also, there's not only the issue of underwriting. There is an issue that played out in parliamentary dispatches through the week, which is the issue of indemnifying any new plant against a future change in carbon policy. Now, I spoke to Trevison Baker, who is a player in the energy industry in Australia. I'm sure you've come across him anyway. He's a fun guy. He said to me, and I wrote a piece, he said basically of Collinsville, there is no way that Collinsville will ever be constructed unless the Commonwealth indemnifies that project against future carbon risk. Like, just not going to happen, won't be bankable without an indemnity, right, which puts taxpayers on the hook for several billions of dollars. So first thing. Interestingly too, he's obviously, he's in Trevison Baker's business. Well, he has mixed businesses, but he's into sweating existing coal assets. So he's a coal guy, let's say. He's a coal guy. Of Collinsville, he said, I actually can't see the business case for Collinsville. Who's the customer? Who's the offtake? You know, so anyways, two issues there.
I just discovered the skeleton in your studio. Yeah. I just turned around a coffin. Yes. It was a skeleton facing me.
Poor Trent has discovered. Yeah. I'll put a picture up on social media so you could see what he's looking at. Poor man, it's terrible. Anyway, so you don't think, obviously, it's good for governments to approach coal plants as if it's some new technology that you have to pull through, right? So there's not a case for public support. What about indemnities? Like, that's a whole other rodeo.
Look, it's not an issue that I've given a huge amount of thought to. I mean, we have an underwriting scheme that arose from the ACCC report, which is meant to be technology neutral, and we're looking at 12 projects. But the underwriting in that context is... And that's obviously about firming. It's really about providing the firm power to support renewables.
Yeah.
And essentially that is a baseline because of the way that market operates in terms of generally you can only get private commercial backing if you have contracts that go for the extent of the investment period.
Yeah.
But in reality, you can only get energy contracts for 5 years, so it fills the valley of death in energy, and that program is meant to be technology neutral.
Yes,
there is
Once and Baker coal project that's on the shortlist, but it's mainly renewables, it's mainly hydro and other
and
things,
pumped hydro and gas, I imagine as well. So there is some potential for some form of underwriting under that. But I think more broadly, and I stress I haven't really turned my mind to this at great length, but I think if you are talking about underwriting the consequences of changing policy in relation to getting our emissions down across the whole energy sector, then that is a fairly massive commitment on the part of the Commonwealth.
Well, it's a brain explosion. Like, honestly, it's quite like the amount of tax, and let's be clear, it's who is actually picking up the tab. It's the taxpayer. Mm. It's not the government. It's the taxpayer. I mean, that's another issue that has to be given serious consideration, because at one level, you know, supporting coal regionally because it's, politically savvy or whatever to do that creates a long-term fiscal consequence. Well, that's highly problematic, isn't it?
That would be my gut reaction, but not definitive reaction. How's that for an intro?
No, I see what you did there. Let's finish with this. Zali Steggall, obviously, who is now your sort of next-door neighbour in Warringah.
Is my next-door neighbour.
Yeah, she is, actually.
Not residentially.
But electorally. Yeah, she is. She totally is. Anyway, she has obviously brought forward a bill, which has been well received. You know, BCA's backed it. Business types who are into climate action, like Mike Cannon Brooks, have backed it. You know, think it's an elegant compromise, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think?
Look, I've had a quick flick through it this week. So the bill itself was released on Monday, I think, and I'm probably upsetting your broadcasting timing.
We're four days
after its release, so I can't say I've had an in-depth look at it. I suppose in terms of timing, I think that the government should be given the opportunity to do that due diligence process on the 2050 target before the Parliament's expected to sign up to it. I've spoken to Zali and I said I'm open to having a conversation about it when we come back in a couple of weeks' time.
Mm-hmm.
So it is watch this space on that front.
Oh, that's interesting.
But as you know, the government determines whether private members' bills
come on or not. Yeah. Exactly. You want to have a discussion. Why?
As a matter of respect for Zali, and she said she'd like to have a chat about it. And to be honest, there are some initial reactions that I have that I actually would want to talk to her about even before raising them publicly, because they might be completely unfair and unfounded.
Are you worried about independent or target setting process independent of government?
I would say that as a general principle, I always hold the view that you shouldn't curtail the elected government to too great a degree.
Mm. Okay. Any other issues apart from that?
Let me work through the bill. You're being
artfully vague. Do you think that there is any? I mean, obviously, there's a question about whether or not that bill will ever be brought on, and that's just a question of numbers and support. Could you see any of your colleagues being interested to vote for that bill in the event it came on?
You mean crossing the floor?
She's asked for a conscience vote.
Yeah. Look, I don't think there'll be a conscience vote.
It's not going to be allowed.
No. I mean, conscience votes are rarely given, as you know. I mean, technically, Liberal members have the right to cross the floor on policy issues, not procedural issues. Yep. It's important to stress, which is the first hurdle.
Yeah.
So I don't think it'll be a conscience vote. But for me, the important thing is what is the goal? Now, Ghazali's bill really does two things. It sets the 2050 target, and then it looks at the bureaucratic
structure
behind it, not to actually deliver particular outcomes, but effectively to be doing the reporting and providing advice to government. So there are two components. It's the role of advice, and it's the target. Zali's bill may not be the only way to achieve those goals.
No, well, you're saying, I think, carefully, that you would like the opportunity for the government to reach a more ambitious climate position without necessarily the Steggall bill being the vehicle to do that.
Well, for example, I think I see in emails to me that it might be put up in March. I think it's too early for the government, for that matter, and for us as individuals, for example, to expect to have reached a final judgment about 2050 targets by March.
Mm-hmm. But you're talking.
Despite my favourable disposition.
Sure, but you're talking, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But okay. I'm open to talking to, there are some boundaries, but. if someone like Zali presents a bill like that, I think we have to treat the crossbench with respect. I worked with Rebecca Sharkey on a bill in relation to the aged care sector last year.
I remember that.
So. Mm. Uh, so it is important.
Oh, well, watch this space, people. Yeah. Trent, thank you very much for your time. Pleasure. And thank you, as always, for listening, everybody. We really do appreciate it. Thank you, as ever, to Miles Martignoni, the executive producer of this show. We'll be back with you real soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.